Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Good to have you all with us. We are about to have a conversation with Karen Hoopert, who I've known for a bit of time. She did a lot of work with Urbanite magazine, where we met. She's a Washington Post magazine writer, and she's appeared in The Nation, Newsday, New York Times, Mother Jones, Salon, Village Voice, author of books like Home Fires Burning, Marriage to the Military, for Better or Worse, and The Curse, Confronting the Last Taboo. She lives right here in Maryland, and she's on the journalism faculty here at Morgan State University. And her latest book is Chasing Gideon, 50 Years of Trying to Make Good on the Promise of Indigent Defense in Gideon versus Wainwright, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice. And Karen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Let me start from the end of your book.
Good.
The reason I want to start at the end of your book, Karen, is because you quote Justice Hugo Black. And as you write, he saw problems as long ago as 1963 when Gideon v. Wainwright, came before the U.S. Supreme Court. There can be no equal justice where the kind of trial a man depends on. There can be no equal justice where the kind of trial a man gets depends on the amount of money he has. That to me, in some ways, is kind of your book, which is about the theme of injustice when it comes to how our court system works in America.
Yeah, and I think what Justice Black was talking about and what the Supreme Court believed that they had finally solved was this problem of unequal justice. And at the time, in 1963, they were so optimistic about the impact of appointing attorneys for people who couldn't afford them. And they really thought that was an opportunity to level the playing field. And that worked for a while. But what's happened since then is the courts have just been flooded with defendants, as you know, and you've talked about a lot on your show in the past, the war on drugs and mandatory minimum sentencing, all of those sorts of things have really flooded the courts with defendants. And it's gotten harder and harder to keep pace with that. And many of the public defenders are carrying huge caseloads today. Yeah.
I mean, we'll go through that in a moment because it's just in Maryland, but across the country, public defenders are just swamped. Can you talk a lot about that? But let's take us back to June 1st, 1962, when they decided to take this case, Gideon versus Wainwright, and talk about what that case was and what it meant in 62, and then we'll jump off from there.
Okay. A drifter named Clarence Earl Gideon was arrested and accused of breaking into a pool hall down in Florida. And he had been through the court system a couple of times. He'd served time several times in his past. He was accused of stealing some change from a jukebox, stealing a couple of beers and a bottle of wine. And he went into court and he said to the judge, he said, "I have a right to an attorney." And the judge said, "No, you don't." And he said, "Yeah, the Constitution guarantees me a right to an attorney." And the judge said, "No, it doesn't. You have to try yourself." So he represented himself quite badly, lost the case, and was found guilty and sent away to prison in Florida. And while he was in prison, he wrote out in pencil on prison stationery this plea to the U.S. Supreme Court saying, "I don't have enough money to hire an attorney," but the Supreme Court took up his case. And
On that basis. On his little writing. That's what's amazing about this.
Because
you have to file these brief upon brief to get through all the court system to get to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And he just wrote this.
And he did it. And it's quite eloquent in a way for someone who was fairly illiterate. It's rife with misspellings. But nonetheless, he makes a pretty persuasive argument. And at the time, the U.S. Supreme Court, the precedent was this case called Betts that said only under special circumstances, like if you're black or mentally ill or whatever, then you might be entitled to an attorney. Sometimes race was an issue for that. But with Gideon, he wasn't arguing from that standpoint. He was just saying, because I'm poor and I've been arrested, I should be treated equal, have an attorney just like the prosecution has.
So as a journalist and as a writer, did you take this on because of your own sense of the injustice, or did the injustice kind of unfold as you interviewed all these people and traveled the country interviewing people and wanted to write a book about this anniversary coming up? And what was it that...
Well, I think for me what triggered, I think I discovered the depth of the injustice as I reported the story. But what drew me to it in the first place was that I had been reporting around the issue for a while for the Washington Post magazine. I'd written a couple of articles about programs, the drug courts or restorative justice programs. And I wrote about a prison for teen boys outside of D.C. And what you can't really write about the courts in this country without realizing how deeply dysfunctional they are. And so I was noticing this and, of course, talking to people, attorneys, judges. And what struck me was that everybody who worked in the criminal justice system knew it wasn't working, knew there was this huge problem. And yet there seemed to be this inability to solve the problem. And so that, I think, piqued my curiosity, like, what's going on here? And ultimately, when I was reporting the book over the course of about a year and a half, that was the question I always asked. Like, why everybody knows this is a problem? Why is nothing being done about it? So...
And we'll come at the end of our conversation talk about why you think that why is. I'm gonna, and what can. If maybe it would take a lot to make this work, I think. But mm-hmm. And not that it shouldn't, but it would take a lot. So let's walk our way through some of these stories. I mean, I think that, as I said, one of the things I liked about the book was the way you picked out a defendant and found a public defender. To deal with the issues that really kind of are emblematic of the whole problem nationwide, and you talk about this, Sean Replogle, and his public defender. It's just, why don't you tell the story?
Okay. Sean was a teenager. He had just turned 18 a few weeks earlier and got his first car. He was working at McDonald's, saved his money, got a used car, went with his dad to get insurance. They didn't have enough money. He waited till he got his paycheck on Friday and was returning from cashing his paycheck, and he hit another car. Another car pulled out in front of him. And he hit a family that was traveling, but an elderly gentleman was driving. And the elderly gentleman was at fault because he had pulled in front and Sean had the right of way. But what happened was the man was taken to the hospital, and while he was in the hospital, the doctors discovered that he had a hernia and operated. And Sean was the man actually ended up dying because he caught an infection from the surgery. And so Sean was accused of vehicular manslaughter for this and had to go to trial. And he actually had a very good public defender, although a very overworked public defender.
Carol D. Hunneke?
Yeah.
Carol D. Hunneke. Interesting woman, she sounds like, as well. But yeah.
She is. And she... was a really committed attorney, but she had tried four cases in the preceding couple of weeks, and she went before the judge and she said, I'm not ready to go to trial with this case. I haven't had, time, or we haven't had the resources in my office to send an investigator to look at the crash site. I haven't had time to talk to the doctors involved, all of this stuff. And the judge said, too bad, you got to go to trial anyway. So she thought about it over the weekend, and she decided to take a stand. And she said, I'm going to go in there on Monday. And she did and said, I can't in good conscience try this case. It would be ineffective assistance of counsel if you make me go forward. In the end, the judge actually backed down. And it's a good thing because what she discovered was that the man's hernia was this pre-existing condition. And his own doctor had said... he'd known about it for years and declined to operate because his health was too fragile. And so Sean ended up being acquitted of the case. But it was an example, of the potentially disastrous consequences, particularly for this young man, Sean. I mean, he was just devastated. And ultimately, anyway, his life has kind of been ruined as a result of this.
As what happened to him.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Sorry. Sorry. I mean, one of the things that – but she also knowing that she was unprepared to go to trial, and she this affected her deeply too. I mean, her work has affected her deeply.
Very deeply, yeah. She ended up switching, asking to be switched over to misdemeanors. Ultimately, she was fired, and she contends it's a result of taking a stand on this.
That's what she says. I mean, when she said when you asked the question, they fired you. And she says, lack of diligence and failure to communicate is their official reason. In my response, she takes a sip of her Rockstar energy drink, a dramatic pause. It was BS.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So
what's your take on that? To talk about what you wrote here and what your take was on her being fired, what her stance was, and what happened, and what that was emblematic of for you.
Well, for me, it was emblematic of some larger systemic problems, one of which was the caseload. She was carrying 101 cases at the time that she had Sean's, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that's too many cases to do justice to. And then also there wasn't parity between the caseload she carried and prosecutor's caseload. So she really dug her heels in here and as a result was fired. She actually has since just been hired back. She fought it through her union and was hired back. But it really illustrated a host of systemic problems. And part of what I hope to do with the book, mm-hmm. by telling these stories, was to kind of take this problem from being something that was abstract and talked about in numbers and statistics and stuff like that, to really take readers through the experience, through the client and through the public defenders, so that you really realize the impact on these people's lives.
And it's interesting. The Betts case is interesting. You write a lot about the Betts case, mm-hmm. which is actually a Maryland case,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And with Gideon, he didn't qualify for that. And what was kind of interesting was actually the Supreme Court, I think, seemed like they hoped he would not be African American, because that was one of the criteria that they sometimes would grant an attorney for. And even his own attorney.
And he wasn't.
He was a white man.
Right.
And even his own attorney wondered that. And it sounds like they kind of speculated about, like, how can we find out whether this is special circumstances? But he ended up being sort of the perfect case to come before the Supreme Court at the perfect moment in time to change the landscape here.
And it did. I mean, it did and it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
As we go through the book, I really want you to kind of describe the pieces you talked about. Because you had different states, different situations, the story of the killing of Elliot Porter and Greg Bright and what happened. That's very compelling. I mean, this is New Orleans is not Washington State.
No. No. But I included a state like Washington State, too, because it is one of the more progressive in this. So I didn't want to just pick what we are sometimes too quick to dismiss. Oh, that's just the South. And
right,
they've
right.
got their problems. But New Orleans does have a host of problems, and they way predate Katrina, but they did get really, really awful on the heels of that storm. But Greg Bright was a man who was accused of killing a local teenager in New Orleans, and he served 27 years in prison for this crime that he didn't commit. And at the time, he had a public defender. He was, appointed this lawyer, and he had a co-defendant in the case. So two defendants, and they tried the entire case in under 2 hours, and his lawyer didn't give an opening argument. He didn't give a closing argument, and he called no witnesses. So it was such a slapdash job, which was kind of business as usual then. And what I try to do in the book, too, is show, you know, that was a case 27 years ago, but the problem still exists. And, you know, even today in New Orleans, it's there's another crisis in the public defense office there.
Now.
Right now. One guy I spoke with had been sitting in jail for 16 months without being an attorney. And
is this the marijuana case or is it the other case?
This is the other. The marijuana guy was there for 2 months.
A nickel bag of weed,
and he was in jail for 2 months. He wanted to plead guilty. He couldn't even do that because he couldn't get into court, and he didn't have an attorney. And this other man was accused, much like Clarence Earl Gideon, of burglary.
Right.
And he was cops said they found him coming out of an abandoned house with some copper wiring, et cetera. And he sat in jail for 16 months waiting to talk to an attorney, waiting to get into court, you know, and ultimately that was due to the fact that the public defender's office in New Orleans had laid off a third of its staff. They'd laid off 21 lawyers that year, and they just didn't have enough public defenders to meet their requirements. And what happened is they sort of get around it because it is, you know, it is this man's constitutional right to have an attorney, he and the 280 other folks who are sitting in jail in New Orleans without one. But they said he wasn't technically without an attorney. He was just on a waiting list for an attorney. So there's a little game of semantics going on there.
And scary for the people who are going through it. I mean, one of the things you write here, and we'll talk about this in a minute, when you talk about Greg, Betsy, you say many of the city's systemic issues that kept him locked away for so long persist today. Greg fought a host of them: inadequate funding for public defense, a casual disregard for the letter of the law when it comes to sharing exculpatory information, unchecked prosecutorial misconduct, regular refusals to provide the poor with legal help from appeals, misaligned financial incentives for public defenders, prosecutors, and the sheriff, an insular judicial culture, and old boy network of cops, lawyers, and judges, and maybe even a racist presumption of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty damning.
That's what I saw. And the record, you know, that's part of also why I spent a lot of time writing about Greg Bright's case in this, because each of those things came to play in his trial. You know, there is such an old boys network going on there. And in Greg Bright's case, he had, when he was appealing his case, it kept going back to the same courtroom. I can't remember. It's courtroom K or something. I don't remember what the letter is. But and what had happened was the man who had prosecuted the original case was now a judge in that courtroom. So it is as if the prosecutor is being asked to weigh in on his own misconduct. So, of course, he kept turning down Greg Bright's appeals. And Greg, not being an attorney and writing from prison, didn't even know that this was the same person. So, you know, and that's not an old story. That's, you know, contemporary. That's going on right now.
I mean, you when you talk to the public defenders and the law professors at Loyola, I mean, they were just saying that the system is completely just broken.
Yeah.
Just broken.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things I was struck by was this, the way that the system was funded down there is largely through traffic fines and parking fines. And on the heels of Katrina, of course, there was, first of all, the cops weren't handing out tickets. And secondly, there was no traffic and, you know, no parking violations. So the money just disappeared and the whole office just completely shut down.
Well, I mean, when you read this entire story and how it was involved and the woman's testimony, everything else, it was just such a grave injustice. But it's the sad part about this, it happens here in Baltimore. It happens maybe not as egregious in some levels as the old boy network that takes place in Louisiana. But the numbers of people, of men and women, who are languishing in prison in America because they don't have an attorney to defend them, because they don't have, and they're stuck there. I mean, this is just, I don't think people understand the depth of the injustices going on here.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I know you've had guests on the show before who've talked about issues like this, but often the cases that the public hears about through the Innocence Projects and other
right.
things like that, people are exonerated based on DNA evidence. And if you think about how many cases actually have DNA evidence to retest, that's a fraction of the cases. So you think about all of the other cases out there where that exculpatory evidence doesn't exist, and you realize that there probably is quite a lot of people that are sitting in prison right now who are innocent but were rushed through the process.
Now, another case you talk about is in Georgia, and mm-hmm. I found this also one. This was also very gripping. And by the way, I must say, you are a good writer, Karen. Always have been.
Thank you.
Because it keeps you rolling. And you do.
I try.
It's like a mystery in some ways. But you talk about Rodney Young. You open this chapter up with this horrendous kind of killing of this young man. And she says she found her grandson, her godson, grandson.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Tied to a chair and beaten to death.
The mother found her son tied to a chair and beaten to death.
And so this man, Rodney Young, her former lover, was charged.
Yeah.
And this guy, Joseph Roman, mm-hmm. was his public defender.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides of this were just, I mean, Roman's story is just as kind of amazing as the other. But talk a bit about that case.
Yeah. And in that case, the public defender, J. Roman, decided to try the case to make the argument that this man was mentally retarded, which was, to me, a perfectly sound argument, sitting there in the courtroom. And I sat there for 2 weeks or whatever while the trial lasted. And this man had been in special ed his entire life. A bunch of his teachers came down and testified to that. He had IQ tests that were not above, average or whatever. And if he was found to be mentally retarded, then he could not be put to death. But the jury did not find him mentally retarded and found him guilty of the crime. And so now he's sitting on death row. And one of the things that his attorney, J. Roman, really regrets, and, he was so upset on the heels of this case that he ended up quitting his job.
No, it's become a bartender, where you said he drinks less now than he did when he was an attorney as a bartender.
Yes. I think that he gave me the best line in the book where he says that, And I actually just saw him last week when I was out in San Francisco. And he was so discouraged because they had so many cases in the Capital Defender's office there in Georgia that, again, he didn't feel like he could really commit the resources and time that he needed to really do the best case. And he, he's a very ethical attorney and I think, feels really guilty that he lost this case. And yet he had a host of problems. If one of the things that they talk about down there in Georgia is they're so strapped for money in that office that they can't hire the experts they need to come testify. So if they can't book these experts in advance, then they're, kind of shooting from the hip, hoping they can find somebody to come in and testify. And they don't have the money to do all the investigation quickly like they need to on the heels of a crime.
And it's the one piece where his daughter says, just one more question, and his daughter nods and goes, please don't kill my dad. It's just it's chilling.
Yeah.
But you write here, to close out, I just want to kind of read this one piece that you wrote in the conclusion and talk about where you think it needs to go, what you're saying here. You're writing here, the public defender system is regularly hemorrhage attorneys who left in a blaze of fury or slowly simmered with resentment until they burnt out after a few weeks on the job. And this inadvertently emerges as a theme among the lawyers I report on in the course of this book. Carol D. Hunneke is a vocal critic of the status quo in the public defender's office in Spokane, finds herself fired. 21 hardworking public defenders in New Orleans are let go, and Greg Bright's attorney at the Innocence Project New Orleans returns to England after several years of immersion in the American system. Miami Chief Public Defender Bennett Brummer fought a pitched battle to limit caseloads and reform the systems. After 30 years, decided not to seek re-election. Joseph Ramond, a committed and passionate public defender in Georgia, quit in frustration after trying his first death penalty case before a jury. So where does it go? Where do you think it goes after all this?
Yeah, well, I think that my hope in writing this book was that the conversation about this injustice and the dysfunction of the courts move outside of the insular world of criminal defense, the criminal justice system in general, where everybody involved in the system knows there's a problem. And what I hope to do was to kind of take it out of that insular world and bring it to general readers so that they can understand the depth of the injustice. And I think that one of the things that I've kind of come to realize after being a journalist for many years is that, to move people to action, I think you have to work on two levels. One, you have to let them understand on an emotional level what the problem is. They have to feel this with the subject that you're writing about. And then you have to give them the tools to act. So they have to understand the source of the problem so that they can understand where the pressure needs to be exerted to fix it. So I hope that people will really at least do a double take now next time they hear some law and order politician talking about, clamping down on this and beefing up mandatory minimum sentences or making this illegal. Because I think that, once they understand the impact of that, I think that people will be moved to act. And I think people genuinely care about fairness. And you can't step into this world without being shocked at how unfair everything is.
Karen Hubert, it's always good to see you. It's been a long time. Thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Karen Hubert's a Morgan State University journalism professor and a veteran journalist, talking about her book, Chasing Gideon, 50 Years of Trying to Make Good on the Promise of Indigent Defense in Gideon versus Rainwright, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, Chasing Gideon. Karen, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.